Welcome to episode 107 of the OmniGamers Club podcast, the podcast for games on all platforms, including McDonald's Monopoly. I am Daniel Winter.
Looks like you forgot your name there. I'm Mark USA. Hello.
I think that's my name. How are you, Mark?
I'm well. Yeah, a weekend full of family stuff. Nice to be talking about games. How about yourself?
Yeah, busy weekend here. We went to the Roundhouse here in Vancouver. There was a new Comic-Con exhibition, basically, for all the local comic artists. But also just a lot of just illustrator friends and a few friendly faces from Terminal City convention, including Dennis Ryan, friend of the show, and a few others. So that was great to catch up with everyone. And today my daughter, who recently joined Guides, had a full event for the day. So my wife and I had a rare date day, which of course meant going to the library to read a book. So exciting stuff.
Everything you want is in the library, as I heard.
Including games.
Very nice.
I saw some D&D source books at the library today.
Cool. Well, Daniel, should we jump into a bit of news? Maybe an appetizer?
Yes. Yeah, I don't know that it'll necessarily be news today. I think it's going to be a little bit of a funky episode. We've both been in a little bit of funk in terms of games played recently and everything that's been happening in the industries. So, firstly, I just wanted to put out a quick correction from last episode. We talked about Molly House being released under the Creative Commons license as a print and play. And I had a message from Mendicant Gamer who advised that, I'll just read his message directly. It said, I was listening to today's episode and noted one quick thing that perhaps you are unaware of. All Whirligig Games, Molly House, Pax Premier, and John Company are Creative Commons licensed for anyone to print and play. These are the games that the Whirly Brothers publish on their own and have always been about making sure that people who can't afford their boxes can still play their games. So yeah, I wasn't aware of that. Molly House being the first of their games directly that I've played. I have played some of Cole's games from Leader, like Root and Arx, but that's great to hear. I mean, I don't know that it necessarily changes anything that we discussed last episode, but always for more accessibility in games.
That's right. More information. And I think that's a fantastic move. More accessibility in games is great, especially since it would take considerable effort to print and play the games anyway. So, you know, even if someone wants to print and try it out and then get a copy later, that's not a problem. More access for more people is great.
Absolutely. Okay, moving on to not so much news, more of a soapbox. I have something that I've been thinking about for a little while now is puzzles and how they fit into the sort of omnigaming spectrum. Are puzzles games? Let's get the taxonomy out of the way, and I will say yes, but in short. But that is, like, at PAX Unplugged last year, I bought a game from Chip Theory Games. They're known for, like, big, heavy strategy games, like Too Many Bones. This was a game published by Rainer Knizia, and I was surprised to see that it is not on Board Game Geek. Namely being that it's a puzzle game. It's basically a collection of basically 10 grams, I think they're called, like the funny polygonal shapes, and you just a series of puzzles that you're trying to fit them into a shape. And it's designed for kids. It's a collection of kids' games, basically, released by Chip Theory Games. So that's beside the point. It just got me thinking about, like, where is the line between what's classified as a game, both more broadly and by the community? Because I think, like, I mean, Board Game Geek is perfectly, you know, capable of defining what they want to include on their website. But I think the larger community can sometimes treat that as a bit of a sacred text as to what we talk about and acknowledge in the game space. So, Mark, what do you think about puzzles as games?
Well, first I'll say that I certainly don't treat Board Game Geek as some sort of revered news source. I actually don't even check it out. I usually go there just to confirm, you know, what year a game was published or, you know, what publisher is putting out the game in a certain region. So, no, I don't follow the latest hotness there. I think a lot of people know that about me. Are puzzles games? I think that I don't think they are in every case, but I think that they can be, and that certainly many popular games are a series of puzzles. We've talked about some of them recently.
Yeah, many games are just broken down into lots of micro puzzles, including many like big Euro games that are really like multiplayer solitaire.
Or many video games. I mean, many escape room games, Blueprints, we just did a feature episode on. We've talked about Myst in the past. I played a lot of adventure games, text-based adventure games. A lot of them are just strings of puzzles together. I think some more formal ones are the ones that have like a sequence of literal puzzles that you have to get through. They're just like levels. What's the example I was thinking of? I think like A Little to the Left. Not really a puzzle because you don't necessarily have to complete them all in one way. Some of them allow you to complete the puzzles in multiple ways. But isn't that just a puzzle? And a lot of these games will have like level 1 through level 105 or something like
that. Yeah, literally just a pick a puzzle from the list and work through it. Yeah, I was thinking about video games specifically because the video game industry doesn't really seem to have that hang up about considering puzzles as games. I'm sure there are some hashtag gamers out there who will get upset about any particular genre, but broadly, like, use just like hundreds, probably thousands of puzzle games on Steam that no one blinks twice. Portal, I discussed recently. There's a whole spectrum even there within like puzzles that are part of a larger story or framing device, and then those like from that are just a list of scenarios. Like Steven Sausage Roll is one I've seen doing the rounds. It's interesting, but even like Portal, for example, the puzzles themselves are really quite distinct from the story. Other than a couple of key moments, they're not really interacting with the story in any meaningful way. You have the story aspect and the puzzle aspect that are pretty mutually exclusive.
I think video games get a pass in a lot of ways because like it's a different medium. And a lot of people can find different ways of having fun. So for instance, if a puzzle was written in paper or something like that, maybe it's a maze game, like literal 2D maze. Hmm. Well, you know, there's really only one way to solve that puzzle, isn't
there? It's a Rubik's Cube, a game, like things like that. But yeah, I mean, like,
speed solving a Rubik's Cube certainly is a game. In fact, they have entire competitions about it. And in Portal, you know, just jumping around and looking in a 3D perspective is part of the fun and the interaction part of that.
You have a form of expression within the puzzle.
That's right. There's more to do than just cracking the puzzle per se.
Yeah, so obviously there is a line probably where something ceases to be a game. I'm not particularly interested in getting into the taxonomy and zeroing in on where that line is. As Omnigamers, I think we lean towards being rather inclusive. And partly where I wanted to talk about this is I've been working through my YouTube backlog and courtesy of unemployment, and found one that I'd missed from game designer Emmabel Holland. She's had quite a few videos recently that I've been enjoying, but found one of her older ones that I'd flagged and missed called Board Games as Puzzles, Problem Design and Player Agency, and found some interesting touches in there. I mean, one key point that she was saying is that taxonomy is only useful in limiting what we want to have a conversation about. And I mean, if there's something interesting to talk about in terms of puzzles, I mean, I'm all for it. So it's pretty simple.
Yeah, it seems really short-sighted to be so limiting when, you know, really interesting games, really innovative new games, or a lot of classic games sort of skirt the edges of genres. You know, I'm thinking of things when they come out that seem very strange to us, like, you know, walking simulators. Walking simulators as a genre were really panned when they first came out, but they're really embedded themselves in that nobody says walking simulator anymore, even though dozens of those games come out every year, maybe even every month, because it really kind of divorced, like, difficulty from a game, you know, like, it's kind of like a ride. It's an experience. And I think puzzles can be like that too. Or what about, you know, solitaire? Like there's no challenge to solitaire per se, except in randomness, right? Like you can, I suppose, as a human make bad choices in the game of solitaire, but no one's going to tell you that solitaire is not a game, right? They literally call it a game, but there's no competitor. And I guess it has a fixed goal and different paths to reach that goal. But oftentimes it's really going to be up to just the shuffling of the deck to see whether you can complete it or not.
Yeah, I said, and similarly, most Euro, you know, economic optimization games ideally have a perfect solution. There is a solution which will give you the maximum number of points, whether you can figure that out. Most games have some variety of abstraction or randomization to sort of blur that line, but there is an optimal path to figure out. Or you might have the option of several paths that you want to pick, and you're still trying to puzzle out what's the best way of getting to that particular end game goal that I chose, right?
Yeah. So I would say, to answer your question that you asked a while ago, are all puzzles games? I would say no, but many are. And I would say that, do all games have to have a, you know, a puzzle to them, or a challenge, or something that has to be cracked or solved? I would say no as well, but many of them do.
Yeah. Well, I'd recommend checking out Emma Bell's video for some other interesting thoughts. She was discussing a couple of video games, namely Baba Is You, one that I don't think I have the brain for, but does have some fascinating ideas of like expression through puzzle solutions. And also Into the Breach, which was on the other end of the spectrum, is like a completely deterministic puzzle, in that there is no RNG, basically. You can plan out exactly and know what the cause and effect is going to be every turn. But it's a wide spectrum, even within what is considered puzzles.
There you go. All right. I don't have any news to bring this week, because I thought we were talking about Spiel des Jahres, but it's a long list, and I don't think we're going to go through all those titles anyways.
Yes, that is. They announced the nominees for the Spiel des Jahres this year. I don't have any particular insightful thoughts there. I've only played one of the 9 games, so go check out that list, I guess, if you care about awards.
Yeah, exactly. If you like that stuff, you already know you like that stuff.
I will say, a friend of the show, Dennis, who I mentioned earlier, was just telling me about Far Away, I think it's called, one of the nominees, and said that he's having a great time with it.
Very cool. All right, what do you think? Shall we move on to the main course?
Yeah, let's jump straight into that. Keep things rolling here. And wherein I reveal my ulterior motive, that preamble about puzzles is all one big setup for a game I'm talking about today.
Very good.
So, I recently talked about my daughter being into marble runs, like watching marble races and runs on YouTube. And with her birthday coming up, I was looking at some of the products that are out there. I've seen Gravitrax is one that I've seen released by, you know, board game publisher Ravensburger, has this sort of kit. It's like a sort of Lego style modular kit that you basically make your own tracks with marble runs and whatnot. And looking at those, I noticed that there was a version called Gravitrax the Game. That is, there's a whole series of these, but the one I saw was Gravitrax the Game Pro with the subtitle Splitter. They're each focused on like one particular component. And so I picked this up partly out of curiosity and to see if she was interested in that. So, that is to say, I think it's an interesting enough product to talk about it. So, unfortunately, as mentioned before, this, as many puzzles games, are not on Board Game Geek. So there's not many specific details about it. And as far as I can tell, it was published in 2023, this particular version. But there is no like designer listed, as far as I could find, which is interesting in terms of us talking about authorial intent. Like, is it a game? Is it art in that sense, if there's no particular authorial intent behind it? But as a product, at least, I think there's some interesting things to discuss there. But Mark, I believe you have played with some of the base sort of Gravitrax system.
Yeah, that's right. My family, my household, has had the Gravitrax base set for a while now. And I think everyone probably got even just a little bit interested in marble runs, especially during the height of the pandemic in 2020, when there wasn't any sports or things to do. Either you got into stonks or online gambling, or you got NFTs. Into marble runs. Yeah, well, that's online.
Yeah.
So marble runs was part of that. And I don't think I was directly related to it. But, you know, I always thought these sort of fun kits are an enjoyable, fascinating thing, especially, you know, if you have younger kids, then you want to teach them about things like physics and make it fun and enjoyable. And, you know, I've always been like a Lego fan since a kid. So putting structures together is always enjoyable. That's a really thing. Professional kit too. The product looks great. The components are really solidly built. And yeah, like you said, it's from Ravensburger, so it's quite professional.
They do look very technical. Like it looks more like Technics than Lego, which is a little intimidating, especially, you know, giving to a 5-year-old. And personally, I've never had much interest in Lego in the here's a box of stuff to figure out yourself. Just give me, I just want a list of things I can construct with it and work through the instructions. But that's partly why I was interested in this game product that gives it a bit more structure. So to describe this in more detail, each one of these boxes, I think it's 5 in total, but each one has basically 30 scenarios. It gives you a small selection of components for these marble runs. It's based on a hex grid, like this hexagonal tiles that slot onto these bases with various shapes of track sort of inlaid into these tiles. And you've got these sort of plastic tracks that sort of clip between them and a few other sort of more fancy components along the way. But this game kit basically has a smattering of these components and then these 30 scenarios that you work through. And each of these puzzles basically it's on a card, printed out card. And on one side it says, okay, here's the components you're allowed to use. And here's where the marbles start and here's where you want them to end. Figure out how you get them there, basically. So pretty classic puzzle. You've probably seen a lot of these games on sort of mobile apps, basically. You can easily picture this sort of drag and drop components onto the thing to make World of Goo is always a little bit similar. We're working with limited resources to get something from A to B, right? Or even Lemmings, I guess, if you want to go that far back.
Yeah, there's games like, I think Bridge Constructor is a good example of popular mobile game series.
Yeah.
That limited pieces and put them together and make something happen.
Yeah.
It's an extension of that entire genre of Rube Goldberg machines.
Yes.
Really, that's kind of the root of them, you know.
Like if
you
Mousetrap. Can think of,
like Mousetrap, certainly. And if you can't picture what this is, it's the opening sequence of the movie Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. If I'm not mistaken, there's a long sequence where Rick Moranis is like trying to make toast and eggs using this strange contraption that he, as a kind of nutty professor, has put together.
Well, Wallace and Gromit making toast and eggs.
Right. And for real old heads like me, there's a classic PC series called The Incredible Machine, I think it's called. And that is a game that kind of gave you those tools and let you create a interactive machine, a freeform, of course, only in a 2D plane.
Excellent. Yeah, so this is working with a pretty tried and true formula, right? But I think there is a couple of things that make this special. If you can't tell, I've quite been enjoying this. In that, for one, it's a product designed to be a toy, first and foremost. And like people will often say, oh, that's not a game, it's a toy, in this sort of very dismissive way. Like, but toys are great. Come on, like we're all got a little bit of inner child left in us still. This has a great toyetic feel. It is designed to be played with and interacted with. It's not just a clunky piece of plastic that you're sort of fiddling with in that sense. And it is there is some great excellent engineering in how everything fits together. And the physics of trying to figure out what goes where, how things interact with each other, is just a great sort of cause and effect trial and error of seeing what works and what doesn't. So I've been enjoying that. One thing is on the other side of those cards, like I said, on the front of each card, it will tell you what you can use. And on the back is a hint, which is something I've not really come across in these sort of physical puzzle games. It's like basically a hint system. I did ask online if there were any other examples of this, and the only other one that I got was there's a couple of Think Fun products, apparently. Their puzzle games include a hint system. But I found that to be pretty clever for what is a physical product. Basically, the hints being, it'll just give you one more piece. Like, this piece goes here, and one more piece of information unlocked for you. All of this, like, there are rules in the game, but it's all completely text-free. So it's language independent, I guess you could say. And it's basically a series of diagrams, like IKEA sort of glyphs, I guess, in telling you how things interact. And like, well, if marble goes fast, it goes straight through here. But if marble goes slow, it falls through here. And that was pretty clever. There are a couple of things that I think it doesn't quite sort of explain that. For example, it gives you a like X number of components. You might have these. Here's 10 components. Solve the puzzle. What it doesn't never actually explicitly tells you is you have to use all of the components, because sometimes you can solve it with just 8 of those components, but you have to find a way to use all of them, as far as I can tell, but it never explicitly says that. So not entirely sure there. There's a couple of the components are hard to tell which is which when with the small cards. Other than that, though, I think it's pretty intuitive and clever the way that all works. So in terms of how the puzzles actually work, what I particularly enjoyed is how it largely comes down to a bit of a deduction puzzle. Very naturally, it sort of leads you to these realizations in deducing the language of the game. Like if because a lot of these components are basically stacked on these plastic hex tiles that will raise them up, right? And if the marble started at a certain height, well, they can only go down from there generally. But to line up, for these tiles to line up, you know that they have to also be at the same height or at a lower height broadly. And so to get everything to connect, you can kind of eliminate, well, if this is at 3 stacks high, then I know this other piece also has to be 3 stacks high, which only leaves me with so many other stacks to mess with. Or that because you only have a limited board space, like that's a bit, these, I think they're 7 hex tiles on one particular baseboard, and you might be using just 1 to 3 of these sort of baseboards, but based on where it is, if the arrow is directly like on the edge, you know it can only go one direction from there if the marble's being directed to an edge of it, basically. So there's all these clever little ways you can start to sand away at the logic and leave you with smaller solutions, which I quite enjoyed. I mean, obviously, like, this is pretty common to a lot of these puzzle games, but I did think it was quite natural in how it leads you to these solutions. Obviously, it starts out with simple puzzles, gradually ramps up. I'm at currently 15 of 30, and 15 was the first one where I started to struggle and had to, I think I'd end up looking at a solution, partly just for time. But I mean, the other thing ultimately is that you solve the puzzle, and hey, now you've got a marble truck to play with, right? And especially like I'll often do one of these while my daughter's at school, leave it set up. She'll come home and play with the truck that I solved from earlier. So it still does also just double as a toy at the end of the day, or you could just use the book of solutions as here's a list of some tracks you could build in your own time.
Yeah, the base set of Gravitrax is basically that. You said you would feel a little concerned about just making something freely, but it includes like quite a lot, like maybe a few dozen example setups. Mm. So these are obviously things that you can create all with the components within the base set, which is quite many. They have those risers that you mentioned. They have the kind of like the diverting branching paths. They have the kind of the end goal, the start. They have these interesting metal railings that you can use to kind of bridge the ball laterally, or you can obviously tilt. And that's quite well engineered as well, so that you can have a gentle tilt, or you can have a more severe one if you want to introduce more momentum and velocity to the ball. And then you can also have ones that have it's kind of like a pool shot. So you have a ball magnetically locked, and then when the ball hits it from another direction, the secondary ball shifts.
Huh.
And they even include multiple different colors of balls, which are all metal in this set, because they're magnetic for one. And the different colors are kind of nice because you can kind of set up a sequence. It's like, I'm going to start with white, and then it's going to go red, and it's going to go green. So really cool ways that you can make your own sets, but use those as a starting point to branch off. And then Ravensburger very smartly sells sort of booster packs.
Yeah.
So those sets will have like one gimmick, or maybe like 3 or 5 separate pieces that you can slot within a track and give it a little bit more zing.
I did see it gets quite expensive buying those individual components. It could be $20 just for, like, here's one really fancy component that you can add to your collection. But the starter sets range anywhere from, like, $50 to $200. There's quite a range within that. But my current plan is if I buy each of these puzzle kits, it's five of them total. If I was to buy each of those and work through the puzzles, at the end of the day, I've got a pretty big starter set going.
Right. And you can get the base set for really all you need to get started, obviously. And they also have like a base set, like, what is it called? I don't know the term that they call it, but maybe like advanced or something like that.
Mm.
And it includes like basically more height.
Oh,
so like okay. More height means higher velocity means more extreme, I guess. And I think that product was even rated at even older kids, okay. Like maybe like teens or whatever.
It was also a junior set, kids. Which is what I ended up getting my daughter, which is more sort of chunky, plasticky pieces and like little animals to decorate your course and whatnot. But they might be compatible. I'm not sure.
But, yeah, it's a really innovative system.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about physics there, and I guess what I haven't really discussed is that the centerpiece of this particular box that I got, the splitter, is this really chunky hexagonal tower, basically, that you have to, so it starts at a certain height, but the marbles run over it, and they fall through this trapdoor, but as they fall through the trapdoor, it flips the trapdoor over, so that the next marble that comes through goes in a different direction, so you start out with two marbles and you both have to get both to the same destination, but on like two different tracks. So you have to like split them up and then redirect them back to the one spot. But there's some interesting physics. And like, if they go over the trapdoor really fast, they don't fall through the trapdoor. If they go slow, they do go through. So there is a lot of physics involved, like, and trial and error to say, well, is this fast enough to fall through? Or do I want it to continue through? Sometimes you even have to get the marble to go down before it comes back up again to get momentum based on how many pieces you're working with. So there are some pretty devious little solutions that you can figure out with this.
Yeah, I was thinking while you were describing the puzzles that it would be interesting to have a sort of like a grading system. Like you can have a puzzle that is, maybe you get just regular completion if you solve it with 10 pieces, but maybe you get like bonus points if you solve it with 8 pieces or even... super, super maximum score if you solve it with 6 pieces or something like that.
Yeah, I'll have to look up if anyone has like put up some other puzzles online. It's quite possible. Like there's some fan-made scenarios out there.
Yeah, the challenge I think with that might be that, because it is so visual, you kind of need like a sort of a CAD program to draw those like isometric diagrams
right.
of the pieces to get them just so.
Well, there is an app though, and I guess you could use that to model some things. There is an app that I think was supposed to, my impression of it was supposed to like give you the puzzles and sort of guide you through it. But as far as I could tell, it was just you could build the models in the app. I couldn't really find the actual puzzles in there. Maybe I didn't look to get deep enough.
That does sound useful though for just kind of conveying, here's a creation I made. Very nice.
Yeah, so I've been really happy with this. My intention is to pick up the rest. Apparently there is a bit of a supply issue getting Ravensburger games into Canada right now, unfortunately. If you're listening from Europe, I believe they're much more widely available over there, so go check them out.
Very cool. All right, I'm going to talk about my game then. This is, you said we were having a bit of a funk, and I would like to dispute that. I don't think I'm in a funk per se. It's just that I'm kind of playing the games we've already talked about.
Exactly.
Playing some games we've talked about in the past and continuing to play Clair Obscur, playing Dragon Quest III HD, things like that, and also continuing to try and play new games that I get from the library. So not quite ready to talk about yet. I was sort of in a fix, so I was trying to find a game that maybe I'd played in the past, a retro title, something that I could revisit. I mentioned a little while ago that I recently acquired a Nintendo Switch Lite because planning that trip to Japan, my old Switch, the old family Switch, is even more busted. Memory card stopped reading, and the battery is not working. So I was quite enamored to see that these Switch Lite devices are so light and cute, and actually pretty well, like, feels more solid than the actual base Switch. because the remotes aren't like rattling in those thin those railings.
Doesn't
so
feel
loosely.
Like a toddler's like leapfrog pad or something.
Yeah, it feels like solidly built.
Okay,
so I really appreciate that. And actually, there's some great like obviously 2D RPGs. There's some great indie titles. And I wanted to play a title I got recently on the big screen and on the light. So I thought, hey, I need some cloud saves. Mm. So long story short is I ended up getting the Nintendo Switch Online because you have to pay that money to have cloud saves. But you also get another perk, which is the Nintendo Switch Online or the Nintendo Classics Library. So... I'm an old person, so I like retro games. And there's two tiers. For, I think, $24 a year Canadian, you get, for a single person, you get access to cloud saves and some other features, plus three systems, three old school systems, NES, Game Boy, and Super Nintendo.
Yes.
And that's at the base rate. And then if you pay extra, I think it's called the expansion pack, you gain access to a lot more systems, GBA,
64.
N64, yes. And then for Switch 2, they will be supporting even some GameCube games.
Yes, yeah.
But they also have things like the Sega Genesis / Mega Drive, which I was a big fan of.
I've just been thinking about a game that I missed on the GameCube was Star Fox Adventures. And I've been hoping and waiting to see if they put that onto the GameCube for Switch 2. So we'll see.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it has. Like I said, I cheaped out and got the basic set. Mm. But I actually did that strategically because there's a lot of games in there.
Yeah, they've been adding a few more piecemeal over the last couple of years, and there's quite a big collection now.
There's about 20 or 30 games per platform, so between three platforms, that's already close to 100. A lot of them I own.
Mm.
I played in the past, owned in the past, or I own through things like the Nintendo Switch Classic hardware. Yeah. But anyways, long story short, I wanted to play this old school game, and I pulled out a title for Game Boy from 1990. So this is black and white Game Boy, or green and green, if you want to be truthful about it, from publisher Capcom, and it's called Gargoyle's Quest. Have you ever played Gargoyle's Quest, Daniel?
No. I feel like I heard you tell me about this before, and I got it confused with like the Gargoyles, like the Disney's Gargoyles, which I'm sure there was a licensed version of at some point.
I'm pretty sure that there was a licensed Gargoyles video game, probably on Game Boy as well. But no, this is Gargoyle's Quest from Capcom, and this is specifically a spin-off of their more famous Ghosts and Goblins series.
Oh, yes.
You probably know Ghosts and Goblins.
Yeah, I
know. Or, or one of the later version, which is called Ghouls and Ghosts.
Yes, yeah.
So those,
Ghouls and Ghosts.
Exactly. Which are also fantastic games. Those latter two games have you playing like a guy called Arthur. I think he's supposed to be a knight. Maybe he's Sir Arthur. I don't know. But he's a knight fighting monsters. And in this one, you play as a monster. You play as the titular gargoyle. And it's a really interesting thing. He has a name. He's called the Firebrand or whatever like that. Hmm. And he looks like he's a non-human. He just looks like a beaked gargoyle. And the aesthetics of this game are totally like, metal album cover inspired. So kind of like everything's burning. Even the trees and the mountains, everything's dark and gloomy or burning. And, everything's kind of like hardcore. Like even the people that your allies are ghouls and beasts and mutants and things like that. But you're ostensibly the good guy fighting for the goblin forces. You don't encounter any humans in this game. And you're on basically this, the plot doesn't matter. You're on this string of MacGuffin hunts, and that's all it is. This game has a very large kind of like owns a large percentage of my brain from youth, because I did own this back then, and I don't remember if I finished it. So I told myself, let me revisit this title. This title is really interesting in that the majority of the levels are side-scrolling platforming levels. And you can do the standard things like walking and jumping and things like that. But you can also gain access to like a hovering feature. So imagine you're, you know, a Princess Peach from Super Mario 2 or something like that. You can have a hover, and the hover lasts for a certain amount of time. And that amount of time is based on a stamina meter. So this game has two stats, basically, health and stamina. What does that remind you of?
I mean, Dark Souls, I presume.
Dark Souls, I guess, yeah. But I was more closely thinking of another game on Nintendo platforms like, you know, Breath of the Wild.
Well, Breath of the Wild, yeah, I see what you mean, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So stamina for okay. climbing mountains doing the gliding and things like that. Mm. So it's very, very much like that. And those stats do rise. So you start with very low, and then ultimately you can access like unlimited hovering. But that's only near the end of the game, and then there's some specific puzzles that you can beat only by having unlimited hovering, and of course some kind of tougher boss battles that you encounter. So most of the game is side-scrolling, but what's strange is that a decent amount of this game is told through an overworld map.
Hmm.
Pretty much like a 2D top-down RPG. It's very, very strange. So, Game Boy, 1990, I think the Game Boy came out in 1989, if I'm not mistaken. So, this is pretty early in its career. But the top-down world looks just like another popular game I played on that platform, Final Fantasy Adventure, which there's a long story about how that game is not really a Final Fantasy game, but suffice it to say, the sprite work is really basic, but serviceable, and I think quite attractive, even this many years later.
I mean, you've been talking about, you know, the heavy metal aesthetics and burning trees and everything. That all sounds incredibly evocative for a monochrome Game Boy game.
Definitely, it is. And this game, like, really lived large in my mind because the top-down, the sprites are super, super small. I think they're 8x8 pixels, which you can't get a lot of information across in that. But when you get into the side-scrolling levels, there's much more detail. It's much more like a little bit closer to like the Mega Man or the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles that they had on that same platform. Much more detailed sprite work. The only challenge is that the window on the Game Boy original is really quite small. There's only so many pixels across. I don't know exactly what it is, but I think it's something like, you know, sub 200 pixels across and tall. So the screens are very small, but the maps are decently large. The platforming is challenging, but not too hard. And therein comes a question that I had to ask myself when I was playing this game. So I told you I've been playing this on Nintendo Switch Online. Have you tried Nintendo Switch Online?
A little bit. I've dabbled a couple of times. I've been meaning to check out, you were talking about Mother, or one of the Mother games recently, which is on the Super Nintendo version. I've been meaning to check that out.
Yeah, Earthbound is Mother 2.
Right, yes.
So it was a localized version. It was called Mother 2. And Earthbound Zero, I think it's called Earthbound Zero, is on NES Classics, which is, of course, Mother 1.
Okay. I did play half an hour recently before getting distracted with another game. The problem with Nintendo for me is just that it doesn't have the quick resume that I've gotten so used to on Xbox. And so having to like load in and load out of games, just I'm not very inclined to like change games on Nintendo.
Yeah, but what Nintendo does have, at least the Nintendo Switch Classics, Nintendo Classics, is save states.
I didn't find it too intuitive though. You have to like go into the sub menus to activate those. I need to get used to that, basically.
Yeah, you do. But what save states let you do, which is quite like not traditional, right? It really breaks a lot of things down, and it breaks the difficulty of games, because those games very specifically did not let you save everywhere.
You had to finish them within one battery charge.
Yeah. And a lot of those games didn't even have battery packs, which is to say they didn't save your memory on cartridge.
Mm.
You would have to type in a code or something to restart at a certain time. Those problems are way behind you in this version, because you can save at any single moment. And it's it serves as a crutch. Mm. This doesn't apply just to Gargoyle's Quest. This applies to any game. Imagine if you could play Super Mario Brothers, but you saved between every jump. Right? It sort of changes the dynamic of the game.
Right, yeah.
This game I probably played and played and played and died and died and died and played and died and probably got frustrated as a 10 or 11-year-old and just let it collect dust for nigh on, you know, 35 years or something like that. But this game I was able to complete in 4 hours, in one day, start to finish. I didn't do it in one sitting. I had to do things like cook dinner and things like that. But through the magic of save states, I was able to basically cheat all the way through. So very much like Super Mario World, there are larger areas of the map, and you have to play individual levels. Like, for instance, you walk up to a bridge, and you have to play a side-scrolling level to get across that bridge.
Okay.
Right? So you play the side-scrolling. Once you reach the final part of that, you're back to the overworld, and you're on the other side of the bridge, for instance. But when you reach a certain inflection point, then you have to fight a boss battle. And there's about six bosses in this game, including the final boss, and they're all quite well designed. Like, the sprites of them are massive. Like, the sprites of them, like, don't even fit on one screen of the Game Boy.
How does combat work in this game?
So combat works, basically, you don't like jump on an enemy or anything like that. You shoot like a little ball of flame out of your mouth.
Right, okay.
But actually, one cool aspect of this game is that you unlock new weapons. Mm. So the first pea shooter is really, really small. And then the second one lets you do like kind of a quick fire one, so you can blast out
a little bit like rapid attacks. Castlevania, I guess, is the comparison.
Yeah, I think Castlevania only lets you swap between two weapons at a time.
Depends on which one, I guess, but yeah. Yeah. Like, it's sort of generally close range melee attacks.
Yeah, this one lets you choose from ultimately four weapons at any given time.
Mm.
And actually, some of them can be strategically used. So one of them is a sort of like this like glob, which is like this big orb that you can use to normally shoot down opponents. But it also latches onto spiky walls. Imagine like the spiky walls from Super Meat Boy or something like that.
Right.
You can shoot at the spike wall and it gloms onto the wall and becomes a latch point which you can grab onto, and you can use it to jump up a sequence of spiky walls all the way up. So just latch on, shoot across the other way, and then jump to the other side, and then jump.
So it's playing with some cool physics for its time.
It's doing some pretty interesting things for sure. So that's, you know, one more cool aspect of it. You unlock those new abilities as you go play through the level. I already told you that you increased your stamina, you increased your HP. What is this starting to sound like to you?
I mean, any overall number of games, I guess.
But it's sort of feeling like an RPG, right?
Okay.
This game is plays surprisingly like a role-playing game.
Hmm.
Despite the fact that all the combat is real-time, all the combat is, you know, there's no menus to be had at all, except when you pause and you choose between the weapons, kind of like Zelda 1.
Hmm.
But there are random encounters on the overworld, believe it or not. So I told you there's the overworld map. You walk a certain distance and then this encounter screen will come up. And you fight these bite-sized encounters, but it's all action-based. It's all action platforming.
Huh.
And the encounter, you encounter kind of these regular enemies, but you have to defeat all of them to clear the screen. And unless you beat all of them, you're not returned to the overworld map. So really interesting that way. It kind of reminded me of a newer game that has an overworld map, an action game, an action RPG, that happens to be called Tiny Tina's Wonderlands.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Also has a feature.
Yeah, it has about that.
An overworld. You walk in certain places. You have encounters which are action-based.
Yeah, sort of mini scenarios.
Yeah, it's very much like that, but even more bite-sized. So this game is doing a lot of sophisticated things for way back in 1990.
Experimenting at the very least, and yeah.
Yeah, so strange that it has a kind of like a RPG philosophy to it, but it's entirely an action game.
This is back when these clear senses of genre tropes hadn't quite been established yet. There wasn't this clear distinction. Well, this genre has X, Y, right?
Yeah, and other 2D genres were really more present then, like Metroidvanias. This game has a little bit of Metroidvania qualities because you gain new abilities, like the hovering. And as you gain more hovering ability, you can cross longer gaps and you can find secrets hidden throughout. So lots of really interesting stuff going on there. Okay, so basically, aside from that, like it's a fairly basic game. The story is nothing to write home about. I think the artwork is fantastic in it. The level design is quite cool. The combat is not terribly hard. Like, it will probably not satisfy any hardcore Castlevania or Mega Man fans. But to me, it was just the right level of challenge. It was obviously challenging enough for me back in the day that I didn't finish it. But I remember distinctly feeling that this is a really epic game. And it was had a cool setting. You're not a human. You're in this kind of like dark world. And
remixing some genres and mechanics in some pretty unique ways, it sounds.
Yeah, and this was popular enough to spawn 2 sequels. So I told you it first came out on Game Boy in 1990. In 1992, they released Gargoyle's Quest 2 for NES, which is apparently a prequel. I didn't play it, and sadly it's not on Nintendo Switch Classics or Nintendo Switch Online. But the Super Nintendo sequel called... confusingly, Demon's Crest was released in 1994, and it is on Nintendo Switch Classics.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so you can check it out there. I think it's pretty mid. This is probably more of a nostalgia choice for me, but I'm glad that I was able to play through till the end, and it's got some interesting decisions in there, interesting, cool tech, and there's definitely worth checking out if you're a fan of that era or just kind of like a gamer historian.
Yeah, I mean, I've played a retro game recently that I've been waiting for the right time to talk about it on the show here. And I mean, it also not a particularly good game by today's standards, but was doing some absolutely fascinating things for its time. And it's interesting to explore these games in the context of when they were released. And, you know, they were trying new things before what we take for granted today. And they were creating these wild new ideas for its time.
That's the interesting thing about looking back at old media, old music, old TV shows, old movies, is that you don't realize how early some of these innovations that we take for granted were happening. And that's definitely the case when I play with some of these older games. And you just see what incredible work people are doing with such limited tech. It's impressive stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'll have to have a look at that myself and compare notes.
All right, cool. It's on Nintendo Switch Classics, so go check it out.
Excellent. Okay. Yeah, well, maybe we'll have another retro segment every now and then.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure we can make that happen.
Cool. Okay, shall we have some dessert?
Yeah, that's right. Let's talk about some non-gaming stuff. How about you? Want to start us off?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of big shows coming out right now that I've been excited to check out, like Andor, which I'm not watching for a couple of reasons, but I feel like you might have a tangent leading into that as well. But instead of watching all these hot new shows, I have been watching an old favorite for the third time. That is Fargo, the TV series. So this is connected to the Coen brothers film of the same name. The first season of the TV show came out like 2016, I want to say. This last year they released season 5. So they've been sort of dropping these out every few years. But we're rewatching the first season right now. And this is set in the same world as the movie. There are a couple of direct callbacks, shall we say. This is set in 2006. So it's not even contemporary to the film or to when it was made. All of these are basically set in very specific time periods and capturing some really fascinating parts of what makes those periods unique. This, I mean, it has a completely stacked cast, as you can imagine. Martin Freeman, Billy Bob Thornton, Colin Hanks, Alison Tolman, all excellent. And it does, this first season especially, does like capture the original film pretty closely, like including it hits a lot of tropes, basically. I mean, the Coen brothers have always relied on a lot of sort of symbolic mirroring of images in various ways. And this, I should say, this isn't by the Coens. This is directed by Noah Hawley, who you may know from the TV show Legion and the upcoming Alien Earth, which I'm very excited for. But yeah, this is a fascinating, really compelling crime drama, very sprawling, even more so than the films. And as with the films, relies so much on these sort of inexplicable coincidences, more so than intent, and just sort of misunderstood connections between things, up to and including acts of God and UFOs, perhaps. But I don't want to get into too much detail, but just to say that those are really excellent shows. I mean, the season one is great. Season two, I think, is my personal favorite, which is like set in the 70s, which is such an interesting tone piece, and an even more stacked cast in there. So, and I've only seen the first three seasons. We're basically rewatching through them to catch up on season four and five, which I've not seen yet. But they are all excellent. You can watch them on Crave here in Canada. I'm not sure about the States, but worth checking out.
Yeah, I had no idea that Fargo had so many seasons to it.
They're all standalone, I should say. They're like, there are some loose connections, but they're all like every season is standalone. Like season two was the first one that I saw.
That's interesting. It must be, I don't know, is that freeing? Is it harder or easier to have sort of disconnected
seasons? We can basically start fresh every season. They all stand alone and explore different aspects and different time periods and different things.
Yeah, I guess other shows kind of sort of reboot themselves every season.
Like, what's the American Horror Story? I guess there's something similar. That's like the same actors playing different roles every season.
Interesting. Another one I don't watch. There's so much TV out there that I can't track it all. And like you, I haven't started watching Andor yet, although I loved season one to bits. Mm. Just trying to fit some stuff in. My wife and I have to watch Shogun before.
Yes.
We head off to Japan, so got to get that happening. Anyways, I do have something Star Wars related to talk about, though. I read a book recently, and this is called Star Wars, Convergence. And this is a novel set within the High Republic series. And High Republic is going to be a little bit of a rant, is highly confusing. And what it is, if you're unaware, is it's set before the stories we all know. It's set before even the Old Republic, the video games.
Okay, I was going to say, I know the Old Republic. So High Republic is before that, right?
Yeah,
The Acolyte was in that time period, I believe?
I believe the Acolyte is set in the High Republic period, but I haven't watched the Acolyte, so I don't know. And in the video game we covered not too long ago, Jedi Outcast, which
Fallen
was the second
Order?
One.
I don't remember the subtitles.
Yeah, the one with Kyle Kestis. The second with Kyle Kestis, there was actually there was a decent amount of High Republic kind of callbacks in that game as well. So anyways, High Republic is set way back in the past. Yoda is the only character that still exists through all the time periods.
You can't keep him dead.
he's a youngish guy there. Yeah. He's still a Jedi Master, but he exists in that period. Otherwise, this is a kind of... this is a prime example of written by committee. This property is so large. They basically wanted to create a new Star Wars universe where, you know, we weren't constrained by anything except the kind of the classic standby qualities of Star Wars. So they're all new characters aside from Yoda. The Republic still exists, but it's a different kind of Republic. And there are bad guys, but they're not Sith. And there are definitely Jedi Knights and Jedi Masters and Padawans. So this book is confusingly part of Phase 2. So there was a Phase 1. There was, and in High Republic, there are all manner of media.
I think we're going to need a flow chart for this, Mark.
There is, but I'm just going to give you the high level. So there's adult books. There's young adult books. There's graphic novels. There's audiobooks. There are children's books. All within this property, media property. And they sort of like dovetail with each other.
Now, are these, is this part of the extended universe? It's like not officially canon anymore?
No, I think these are canon because this arose within since the new movies.
Okay, so this is recent? Okay.
Yeah, that's right. This is still ongoing. I had no idea there was going to be a phase two, but phase two there is. So I've read the three adult movies from books from phase one. They were okay. There's some interesting things going on. And then I'm reading, this is the first book of phase two, and it's a prequel. So it's a prequel to a prequel. So there's even more kind of confusingness going on. And this book has good and bad things going for it. First of all, good things. The characters are quite relatable and likable. I like the main cast a lot. It's essentially a kind of a Romeo and Juliet story. There's two worlds that are sort of non-Republic worlds that are caught in this never-ending conflict. They're at war with each other. They hate each other. And they're all like at starvation's door, both sides. And of course, the Galactic Republic would like them to come to peace. And one of the sides calls out to the Jedis for assistance. So lo and behold, of course, the Jedis show up. And there's a sort of like encounter, a kind of tense opening set piece. And then one of the princess of one of the worlds crash lands on the other world and is discovered by the prince of that world. It's the story of their relationship. They are enemies. They're kind of, but they, through for political reasons, they decide to get engaged with each other. And they kind of do it even before they come to like each other, but eventually they do come to like each other. And essentially the main plot of the story is that they're on a relief tour of the two planets as a combined force, the prince and the princess. And they're accompanied by a young Jedi and this kind of like scoundrel character. So it's got the all Jedi the make pieces. It worse. Yeah, definitely. I mean, the Jedi are not the most important force within this novel. That's actually a good thing. The two young people, the prince and the princess, are. And kind of playing against stereotypes, the princess is like a soldier in the more militaristic culture. And she's like a pilot. She's like an X-wing pilot, essentially, for their military. And through a battle, she crash lands on the other planet. And of course, one is desert and the other is water world. So of course, there's those contrasts there. And the prince playing against type is the more kind of like the passive or the more, not passive, pacifist, I should say. And he's not a fighter, but you know, he's got some talents and qualities to him as well. And the Jedi are really interesting. Like, thankfully, the two older Jedi kind of get out of the way. And the younger Jedi is allowed to kind of take the fore. And she is kind of has conflicts herself with, like, the Jedi Order. So, you know, it's definitely a new generation Jedi Star Wars story where, you know, the Jedi aren't perfect, right? And that's been, I guess, the kind of the biggest challenge of the newer Star Wars properties is that, yeah, the Jedi are not infallible, like we all were told that they were in the good old days, the more civilized
times. The franchises can't escape them. They keep leaning on that crutch.
Yeah, it's true. Thankfully, this one is fairly minimal in that way, and there's other things to like. So there are some good things going on. Otherwise, the plot is generally pretty generic and kind of predictable. You kind of know where some of the things are going. There is one character who is a sort of is he good, is he bad sort of character. So that provides some interest to it. But here's the thing. Here's my problem with the High Republic. There's a lot of good things to be said about it. The production design is some of it is quite cool. Some of the characters are really interesting. Kind of the situations are interesting. In the first trilogy, there was a trio of Jedi, and actually two of them were kind of in love with each other. So they were already Jedi Knights, masters, but they had to kind of put away their love for each other. And that was a source of conflict, which is interesting. And the third one kind of became evil, which is also interesting. In this one, the problem with all of High Republic is that there's no Sith. There's no defined kind of villain. There are villains. And there is even a villainous force, but they're not worthy of the Jedi, right? Like, the Sith are worthy of the Jedi. Galactic Empire, is worthy of the Jedi to be opposing forces, right? The enemies that they do have in these books are not worthy. They seem like they're the underdogs. So it's that sort of power imbalance, right? Last time I talked about Overlord, where the main character starts as stronger than everyone. That's not interesting. You know, if this is the height of the Republic, where everything is supposed to be good, they have all the resources. No, there's not this underlying force trying to take them down, but they still can't get their stuff together. It's a little unsatisfying. So that's the main problem I have with High Republic. That said, for some reason, I'm still reading this thing, so there's some good qualities there, but I wouldn't say go out of your way if you haven't read or watched some of the more mainline Star Wars stuff.
Yes, I mean, I'm sure there's no shortage of Star Wars books out there today, both old and new. You've got every yeah. flavor covered under the sun there.
Exactly. And there are more, like, more universally well-loved series, like the kind of the Thrawn trilogy for the original series, of course.
I mean, one of the podcasts I follow, A More Civilized Age, they've been covering some of the Thrawn books recently, I think. So I've been curious to check those out.
Yeah, I really need to reread those. I restarted the first one, and there's some really interesting choices that they make there. Some of the things that like Luke and Leia and Han end up doing are just really interesting in retrospect, now that you know about where their lives went to in the future. So there's interesting stuff up there for sure.
Excellent. Okay.
All right. Shall we wrap it there?
Yeah. Just over an hour today. Let's keep this short, because I think we may have a couple of longer episodes coming up for reasons. If you've got any questions or comments on today's games or Star Wars novels, you can contact us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com or at our website, omnigamers.club.
That's right. You can catch our videos on YouTube. If you haven't seen those there, like and subscribe. Leave comments, please. That's always appreciated. And of course, if you're not yet a subscriber of the podcast on your podcatcher of choice, go find us. We're everywhere. Spotify, Apple, Android-based apps. We're all there. Give us some likes there also. It helps people find us. And of course, the best thing you can do for us is to let a friend know that they should check us out. Watch some episodes. Maybe there's a game that you both love that we've covered in the past.
Yep, word of mouth is the most powerful force for podcasts out there. We're not on any of the big social media platforms, because they're all terrible now. We are on Blue Sky, so you can find me there at Board Game Feast, and the podcast has its own account there as well.
Yep, and you can find me on Blue Sky as well. I'm Omnigamer Mark. We're talking about this and other things we're doing there as well. So go check us out.
Yes, and we do have a couple of exciting guests lined up for next month. So stay tuned there to hear more about that.
That's right. Always more things in the works, and there are some newer games that I've started playing as well. So more to talk about next time.
Yes, I have a new TTRPG, one shot, but a new game to try lined up very soon. So excited to talk about that.
Very cool. All right. Well, until next time, Daniel. And everyone out there, I hope you have a balanced diet of gaming.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.